Hi, and welcome. Let's see. There you go. That's a good angle. Welcome to Teaching ATM Better. So I'm doing this is the second session I'm doing today. This is an introduction to it's part of the reason I'm doing this is I'm starting returning to the source. I'm teaching that for the eighth time. I'll tell you a little bit about that later. I had one idea when I put this together, and I think I mentioned this morning here. Let me hold on a second. Let me just. I'm going to chat. I'm going to just mute you all. So for the sound quality, you're welcome to unmute yourself or wave or raise your hand if you want to say something. Anyways, I had an idea of what I wanted to do, and I have been writing and working for the last few days. Working on a chapter for a book about the chapter I'm working on is about training Feldenkrais teachers. And my neighbor's mom would have said when I grew up, I was sort of full of piss and vinegar this morning. So I just kind of went off on not a tirade, but it wasn't exactly what I had in mind. And I don't know. I don't think it's what other people had in mind. I think it was interesting, and I'll share it. We ended up staying on the conversation like an hour longer than planned, and I think 2/3 of the people hung out. So it was definitely valuable and exciting. And then I didn't plan it, but I ended up having a couple of really long conversations with a couple of people I didn't know afterwards on the phone. So I've been really inspired, and I went for a bike ride before we did this because I just needed a little. What is that? Movement, and a little. It was a beautiful day, so got to be outside. I want to talk a little bit, and set the stage, and then we can see what happens. I have no compunction to try to repeat what happened this morning, especially since it's been recorded, so we can do something else. I made a declaration a couple of years ago that the new courses I was going to develop, advanced trainings, would be based around teaching ATM. And that's because I have, you know, I just think that ATM is the future. It's the future of the method. It's our way of reaching people. It's what we have to offer folks. I love functional integration, but the capacity of what ATM has to offer, I think it's barely been touched. I know in a lot of trainings around the world that the structures kind of evolved so that at the end of the second year, people do an ATM teaching practicum, they get a stamp of approval, and then they go teach ATM, and then the focus shifts to teaching functional integration. And ATM kind of gets left behind, you know, it's the poorer relative. It's the I don't get no respect part of the Feldenkrais method, I think. It's kind of taken for granted. Not necessarily by those of you here, because I recognize you from the AYA Day group and from other things that we've done and things that you've done. But there's this kind of thing like, okay, well, that's the easy stuff. Let's get to the meat of it. Let's get to the real, the tofu, if you will. The real stuff of the method, which is doing functional integration. I think it's a false dichotomy. The other day in the AYA Day group a couple of weeks ago, and we were watching an FI once a week there, the group is watching one of Moshe's FIs. If you're a member of your national guild or professional association, then you're a member of the IFF. You have access to the FIs online for free. That was a plug for the IFF. But you know, it was an interesting lesson where it was not the first lesson. He was working with this gentleman who had a stroke, and it was a very hands-on ATM, or it was a very active FI. I'm not really sure, but it was really more ATM than FI. And that seems so much. If we separate them out, then we don't see that as a possibility. Like they're two different things. And what I think, what I've realized, you know, over the years, not just of being a Feldenkrais student and of being a teacher, but I think over the last 20 or so years, half of my time as a trainer has been working with Feldenkrais teachers, North America, Australia, New Zealand, all over Europe. And I think there, you know, I've had a perspective on what we say happens in the training and what happens and how people are prepared. And, you know, I've taken a slightly different approach in trainings, in that we continue to work on teaching teaching ATM in the final 2 years of the training. Because I think as you get better at doing FI, you understand ATM better. I think, you know, after the second year of the training, when those people who are feeling excited, ready to teach, the rules are you can't teach FI because you're an ATM teacher, but there's no reason why you can't do individual ATMs, right? And I think in terms of, if you'll pardon the phrase, maybe it's a little tired, but in terms of empowering their students, you know, guiding them through FI, through ATMs on their own, doing half the lesson as an FI and half as an ATM. These are ways to help people realize that, you know, it's not our magic hands, it's their abilities to learn that matter. And I have, since I started my practice, you know, explored with different ways of working with people using ATM. This morning I talked about working with the bus company here in town, the Transit District. But, you know, I've worked with orchestras and dance companies. I've worked with bank tellers and gardeners. I mean, as groups, you know, in trying to figure out, exploring different ways of making the work accessible. So I have this really profound sense. It really invades my dreams sometimes, and my thoughts at other times of the day, that this is the time, historically speaking, for the method. You know, people talk about neuroplasticity. I just feel like this is a moment of possibility. And so I'm curious about how we go about teaching ATM. And two things in particular: how do we talk about it so that we invite people to participate? I think the bar is too high. I think, like for me, I want to make the method more normal, more everyday, less special, you know, so that people can understand it as a part of everyday life. When I was in graduate school doing my kinesiology studies, I attended the advanced seminar in composition in the music department with Herbert Bruhn for almost the entire time I was at the university. And Herbert, who I knew through the world of systems and cybernetics, I had known him for a couple of years. And one night when he was over for dinner, he told me that he got to leave Israel and come to Illinois to teach at the university, and Moshe had paid his taxes for him. He had never told me in all those years that he knew Moshe. At first, I was kind of mad at him, and then I was like, I'm glad he didn't, because we have our own relationship. But from Herbert, and I went to this class because I was interested in lessons as compositions and how they're structured, you know, how they're structured as an educational experience, but also as an emotional experience, how they carry you along. And Herbert, I mean, he was a great pianist. He lived in a little apartment, and his piano lived at my house. He would come and play for dinner once a week. with Susan Parenti. It was really pretty fun. But anyways, he had done all kinds of experimental things, computer-based composition, electronic music. He knew people from all over the world. So people would come to a composition class and they would play, three foghorns and a boat, or punk rock opera or whatever. And sometimes it was live performances, sometimes it was recorded. And one of the questions that I learned to ask from Herbert, he said, when we listen to a piece of music, most of us ask ourselves, how does this music fit into our world? What does it mean to us? And, the music that we listen to, I have a great range of music that I enjoy, but some of it I would definitely put in the noise category. Wasn't my thing. And I love Philip Glass, but I also like melody, it's there's a wide range there. And some of the music was hard to listen to. And his challenge was always, can you imagine the world in which this piece of music belongs? Can you imagine the world in which this piece of music belongs? And that question, I asked it with these other amazing people. I'm not a musician by any means, but I'm a writer and a choreographer, so I could appreciate this composition idea. The question started to work its way into my thoughts, and I started to ask myself, can we imagine the world in which the method belongs? Right? What is that world? What is the future that we want to be a part of? If it's not exercise, and it's not rehabilitation, and it's not therapy or spiritual development, not that it doesn't have effects in all those domains, what is it that we offer? Right? And, my vision here is that, the word that it comes down to for me is coordination. That's what we do. We help people coordinate their sensation and their action, the sensory motor loop. We help people coordinate how they navigate through the world. We help people coordinate through the whole journey of life, getting used to the changes in our ongoing changes in our physical bodies. I imagine a world where every neighborhood has a Feldenkrais teacher. And just like people know when to call the plumber or the piano teacher, they know when to ask for us. And so having a vision of that world, for me, I can begin to think backwards. If that's where we want to go, what's the next step in that direction? So for me, that's one question. What's our vision? And what's one that we can get behind together? Because I think each of us doing it by ourselves isn't going to do it. And, getting starbucked by some corporations is not going to do it. So what kind of affiliation or association do we create? That's one thing. That's about what we have to offer and how we offer it. And the other thing is about teaching and how we teach the method. And I asked some questions in the email I sent out, and we could talk about that. But for me, that's the landscape. And since I've done so much talking today, I'd like you to rescue me. I'd really love to hear what you have to say and what your experiences are, what you're wrestling with. I'm glad to contribute, but I, if possible, it's usually hard. I'd rather be a part of the conversation than just talking. So, I know some of you from the AY Day Group. I'm going to say this again, not for any other reason than I think it should be said. Norma was my first ATM teacher, and it's great to have her here. And this is a conversation that's been going on with some of us for a long time. And some of you I know really well for many years, I'm glad to say. And some of you I know a little bit. But I'm really curious about how we can, I think it's time to stop driving into the future, looking in the rearview mirror, right? And to start to ask, what kind of future do we create? How do we create a future that's congruent, that fits the spirit of the method, and that's open to other possibilities? So I'm I'm really curious. Norma was my first ATM teacher. Norma Lysico, who is on this call. Well, actually, she wasn't. Somebody came to a workshop that I participated in, did an ATM. I'm not sure who that was. I didn't really like their teaching, so I'm not trying to figure out who it was. But Norma was, that was before I did the training. I was 19 years old. I was in a training for Gestalt, to learn how to do Gestalt therapy and transactional analysis. That's how long ago it was. But then when I got in, when I applied for the training, I was a leper. I missed the first year, so I did the makeup. And between the first summer and the makeup, which started in January of the next year, Joan Spencer, who lives up the road from me in Scotts Valley, I would drive up to her house 8 miles away, and then we would drive, I don't know, 92 miles up to Union Street to wherever your office was, Norma, up to San Francisco, an hour and a half one way, do an ATM class and drive back. And we did that all fall. But that was before the training. And that was the beginning for me. It was a good beginning, Norma. Great beginning.
Great. Larry, it's so great to hear your actual history. I didn't know you were driving so much and doing all this going back and forth and exploring in such an active way. It's wonderful to hear about your university work too. It's like knowing someone, meeting someone, like I met you, you came to my class, and just feeling great about this person. We're happy you were there. And then not knowing another thing about the person for 40 years. It's been at least that. So
not quite, but almost, yeah.
It's kind of a science fiction in a way. It's a beginning of a science fiction story. But I love it.
Well, and like, there's something important there. Like, I think I'm old enough now. I don't have anything to prove. I don't want to convince anybody. I'm interested in people who, who have the same values and the same interests, because I think we can do something together that, we can't do alone. Lori, no problem asking me to repeat things. If you can just wave at me if you're online. Yeah. And it is being recorded too, so you'll get the recording. So I think at least one of the things I said might have sparked something. So I'm really curious to hear what it is. Hey, Angela.
Hey.
Good morning.
It's almost lunchtime here. What sparked my interest is this idea that it is our time now, that the method can grow exponentially if we do have a strong vision of the future and not concerned too much about what's happened in the past and the language that we use. I see it all the time. You know, myself, I've experimented a lot with what language I use to encourage people to come and try. And then I see so many practitioners just make it too clever and too far out from just general public that it kind of disassociates them from the general public wanting to come and try because it feels too clever in the wording. And being part of a few different yoga communities, and they're having a renaissance, that they're calling it, a yoga renaissance, and they're looking at other methods and somatics, and they go and see what we put out for free, but yet they don't make that next step to try and learn from a practitioner, a lot of them. Some of them do, that are really interested to learn and understand in a deeper way, but how do we encourage, those people that are already asking questions that we can answer and present it in a way that encourages to come and come across to us. So well, that's what sparked my interest.
And what's your answer? What do we have to offer those people?
Which the general public or the practitioners, the movement, other movement practitioners?
Yes. there's this commercial a couple of years ago. Oh my gosh! But anyways, on television for Monsanto, a chemical company. I think it was Monsanto. It might have been somebody else. But anyways, the commercial went, "We don't make the things you use. We make the things you use better." And I've been thinking about that commercial. We don't make the things you use. We make the things you use better. You know, it's like you don't walk into the pharmacy and say, "Hey, could I have some chemistry?" Or the petrol station, right? Did I get that right, Angela? To the gas station and ask for chemistry, or the grocery store for that matter, or a clothing store. You know, chemistry is what makes those things. And I'm starting these days to think a little bit about our method like that. We make whatever somebody does better. That's a coordination angle, right? And so, and that's a territory that's unclaimed. Right. It is, these days I tend to say neurophysical education, because I'm a kinesiologist and that's a nice way to say PE. And I think we belong in physical education. The difference is our understanding of the neurological part and also of the physical part, what that means in terms of Moshe's background with judo and so forth. You know, it's like, I said this morning, and I promised myself, like, beforehand, I wouldn't talk about it, but I said it anyway. So I've been thinking, like, the title for a book that would be great would be, and I say this to people a lot these days when I'm talking to them, and they ask me what I do. I said, well, look, when most people want to improve themselves physically, they think about getting stronger. And that's only half of it.
Well, I tell people it's... to help them move, enjoy movement more and feel better moving. And part of it is the people I talk to tend to be older people, you know, who are creaky, or they're 50 and they feel 80. And so that's...
Are you looking at me when you say that?
I'm looking at myself. I feel like I was... prepped for old age by when I was in my 30s. I just really had a bunch of hand and arm problems. And all these people in their 70s discovering what I was forced to discover in my 30s, I think I kind of lucked out in a way. But one of the things that's interesting in the, I have a mule, not a horse, but in the...
I remember.
Yeah, in the equine world, there is a whole group of people going off into attention, paying attention and waiting. And it's so funny because the mule, you know, people tend to say, oh, you've got to be the boss and all this. And I have found just standing and waiting has worked better than trying to use any kind of, I'll call it force, but... So I feel like I've heard a couple of Feldenkrais people say, well, we don't belong to the guild anymore because they keep promising us that we're the next wave and, you know, and then we're not. But I just feel like there's now there's more interest in among people I'm around. I just talk about the physical sense, although I think it can make you more, the method can make you more creative and have better dreams and all kinds of stuff. But I feel like more, you know, this idea of paying attention is getting more interest among the people I'm around than maybe 10 years ago when everybody thought it was strength training. And I'm laughing at Angela's.
I am too. I'm waving at Angela's kid there. Hey there. Can I have a piece of your apple? Sorry, Anne. You know, that's why they say show business, animals and children, right?
I had kind of said what I was going to say, but I kind of feel like what you said at the beginning, there's, and this whole emphasis now on neuroplasticity and stuff. I know there's a lot of people who have never heard any of that, but I tend to be around people who, you know, they read AARP and they have heard of this stuff.
Yeah.
That's American Association of Retired Persons.
I love the idea you're speaking about two things, and Angela was too, about the wording, about how we're, and thinking about what kind of future we want to create for ourselves. I love the idea of just plain talk about what you do, and if you can find the words that work, that you believe in. I hate to say a negative thing, but I must say in contrast, I don't like to advertise my classes or see classes advertised that kind of promise simply by the way they're worded, extraordinary things. I mean, I like extraordinary. I like magic. But I'd like to maybe have a little more sense of humor in the words we use. I'd like a more humorous future and at the same time, more ordinary. And, you know, I want to bring my dog to class. And just as an expression. But truly, the simplicity, I like to grow. And when you said, Larry, you said in the beginning about what kind of a future do we want to create for ourselves that we could live and thrive in, so to speak. I realized when you said that, I cannot imagine any future except a future that would be difficult and that I'd have to struggle to get clients and to make a living and worry about living on the streets if I don't make, you know, it's just like my own attitude has to change too. So I need the humor too.
Yeah, well, you know, I love that you said that. And I miss my canine companion. He's no longer with us, but he was with me when I became a widower, and I took him everywhere. He went to all my classes. He went to trainings. I taught at the San Francisco Art Institute for one of their intensives, and they're like, well, would you like to come and teach? And I was like, well, what's your policy about dogs? He said, well, we have a no dog policy. And I said, I have a no without dog policy. And they made an exception, you know? So Oswald went with me everywhere, you know, and he was at the center that I ran here in town. And so I think that's a great metaphor. And I think the sense of humor part is really great. What you said reminded me of something that I've been thinking about for a long time. And I've said this to other people, but now I get to say it back to the person who said it to me. So, Paula, years ago, we're sitting at your apartment in New York. Or I think we're around the corner for dinner. And you said something which, I don't know if you could tell at the time, it really annoyed me. I mean, it stuck in my craw ever since. And you said, and I'm paraphrasing, so I hope I get the sense right, that we're talking about the method and, you know, all the conversations that we've had over the years about this very subject. And you said that until we can make money, we won't be successful. And I think that's, you know, what you just said, Norma, reminded me of that. You know, it's like to offer something in the world and to make something, not because we think it's important, but to offer it in a way that other people find the importance in it, also means that we can succeed, that we can have something that is valued and that people will recognize and pay for. And I don't want to reduce the method to that, but the more I've thought about what Paula has said, like, you know, for me, it's the success of the method, and it's the success of us as a community, of people who care about the world that we live in and we want to do something about it. And I think what we do is incredibly valuable. I mean, we have to see it in that perspective and we have to offer it that way. So, you know, what I was saying before, for me, what is unique about what we're doing is that it's about coordination. I mean, Moshe called the Awareness Through Movement book in Hebrew, that is to my understanding, because obviously it's Rosh Hashanah and we're here, so I'm not the best Jew in the world. But, you know, what Moshe said, I don't speak Hebrew for sure, but what Moshe called the book was developing abilities, right? That's what we're about. I think that's a common place to meet people. When I talk about coordination, you know, coordination's a good news, bad news joke. When you learn something well, it becomes unconscious. That's the good news and the bad news. That's not a failure of the system. That's a feature of the system. That's how we're built. And I think we have an understanding like no one else in the world about how people learn and can change and develop their abilities. And that's what I think is special about what we have to offer. I'm looking at my bookshelf. There's a book that was written by two PTs who taught at Columbia University and very academic. And they were basically, it's an argument for why we need the Feldenkrais method, but they're kind of wandering around looking for it. I'm like, hi, we're over here. We know how to do this. And I think that's the place to start. I think that is what is, you know, I mean, if we can help people do the things they love to do better, what is better than that? Please, Paula, go for it.
I agree with coordination, but I'm not sure I like it. For me, this method has been about and will continue to be about, because it's been so incredibly powerful for me, about resilience. And what excites me is bringing in the changes we're seeing and the leaps and bounds we're seeing in pain science. And I also like to think about how this method helps with mental health as well. Because what I see with the people that, you know, that resonate with the Feldenkrais method, because I come to it from chronic pain, is not necessarily pain relief, but a bit more resilience. And that resilience carries through on so many levels for me personally and for those that I've worked with and studied with. And I recently lost my mom, and so going through a grieving process and having the method has been, I couldn't really imagine going through that experience without the tools that I've learned, you know, studying to be a practitioner. But just finding that, you know, that's it's coordination, but it's deeper than that for me. I don't have the words to put around it that are lovely and elegant that we could sell to the public, but I will think about it. Because it's a coordination, but it's not just a physical coordination. It's a coordination among all states. You know, think, move, sense, and feel. It's coordination with everything tied together. For me. You're muted.
Larry, you're muted. We can't hear you.
Sorry, I shut myself off so I wouldn't be mumbling away here. Thank you. Lori, I really appreciate what you said. I lost my mom a couple of years ago, so I feel you. And like, I personally don't think I would have made it through my life without the method. Some of you know why that's so, and the rest of you, well, you can read my autobiography someday, maybe. But speaking of autobiographies, if you love to read, Edward Snowden's autobiography, Permanent Record, is amazing. Just amazing. I don't know what your politics are, but it's an incredibly well-written book. I almost didn't make it here because I've got like 15 minutes left on the recording. I was like, I want to hear the end. But it's great. You know, Lori, I do think that that's a really important aspect. I think back to the Awareness Through Movement book and where Moshe is talking about, you know, this idea of feeling, acting, sensing, and thinking, that we're addressing the whole person. And he asked this question, why do we start with action? Right? And his answer, I'm going to paraphrase, but his answer is, well, you know, you can have a thought stuck in your head, like the latest McDonald's jingle or some song. You know, you can have sensations, sadness or pain that are hard to get rid of or to change. And same thing with emotions. Emotions have half-lives. You know, they're not something that's shut on and off. But we can change how we move from moment to moment. And I think as a movement scientist, you know, that's my doorway into the work. I think movement's the wrong word, because movement's not necessarily meaningful. Action is. So for me, that's where we start. But I think the goal is, I think it's resilience. I mean, like, the summer last spring and the summer, I was doing some research inspired by Moti Nativ from Israel. He had come to work in the training and in my training in Amsterdam, and done a public workshop that we sponsored with the Dutch Feldenkrais Association, the Netherlands Feldenkrais Vereniging. And I started to do some research into the background of judo. And what struck me is that every book I read, every pamphlet, every website started with the sentence, judo is based on jujitsu. And, you know, it got me interested in Kano and Jigoro Kano, the guy who developed judo. And, you know, Kano was dedicated to taking the samurai martial art and turning it, well, ostensibly into a sport. But I think what he would have said is that his mission was to bring body and spirit together. You know, and that judo was something that, no matter how big you were, or how strong you are, or how old you are, that everybody could do it. And that it was a method of self-development. And maybe we would say body and mind together these days, I don't know. But I think it's important to be connected to that tradition. I mean, Kano was a shrimp. He was a teeny little guy. Nobody wanted to train him, right? I mean, he had to fight to become trained. You know, there's his resilience and his courage to be able to do that and to take apart this violent art and to find in it, you know, this way of fighting full on without hurting people. And, you know, judo means the gentle way of going with rather than against what's happening, a little more Taoist maybe than Zen, I don't know, but it's, you know, our method stands on that. And I think, you know, that there is that ability to be connected to our strength, or our ability to respond. You know, and it's a concrete way of approaching that through how we, you know, live physically in our skin. So I wouldn't want to argue against anything that you said.
Hi, it's Paula Batson, and I have to give a little more context to what I said to Larry.
Sorry.
It sounds kind of cruel, but I think people need to understand that I come from the startup world as well as the corporate world. So I've worked for very big corporations, and I've worked for many startups who have had new products and services, and then they've had to raise money, and then they've had to try and get their product accepted. So, you know, the one thing I will say is that I love what everybody said, and Larry, what you say about ATM, you know, one of the things that we've never had in the Feldenkrais method is scale. Mm-hmm. So if a product or a business is to succeed, it needs scale. And if in every city in which we lived, there were 10 practitioners teaching ATM at various places instead, or 20 practitioners, if there were ATM classes offered in lots of different settings, in yoga classes, in PT offices, at rec centers, at senior centers. I mean, you can think of all the different places that people could offer ATM classes. But, you know, it's one of those chicken or the egg things. When there are not too many ATM classes, then when you go to a place and you want to offer ATM classes, they don't know what it is. They're not willing to have you. But the more people who can, you know, get into the door, the more scale we have in terms of the ATM classes. This actually is an attractor for money. And so when I talk about money, I'm talking about, you know, the gross income for all Feldenkrais services in the US. What is that number? Where's that number going? Has that number gone up year to year, or has it declined year to year? I mean, these are all sort of basic things that if you were looking at a business, you'd want to know. And so I've always hoped that, you know, the attraction of Feldenkrais would attract money, because, you know, it's going to attract people, but that attraction also means revenue, and revenue means growth, and it means more investment in Feldenkrais. It means people saying, oh, I want to start a Feldenkrais center. Look how well these centers are doing. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, sometimes, you know, I think about like the world of entertainment and selling a ticket. So if you want to sell a ticket to a concert or a play or an art exhibition, you know, people have to feel like they're going to get their money's worth. Mm-hmm. And you actually probably want to give them more than their money's worth. That's my philosophy of good entertainers. You leave thinking you got more than what you paid for. And, you know, I think this method has such an opportunity to, I mean, as somebody said, Norma, about humor, but, you know, we can entertain people, keep their attention. You know, what is entertainment but keeping people's attention? So to actually have somebody's attention for 45 minutes and they're in the moment, they're listening to you. I mean, that is better than going to a spa. That's, you know, that's better than a massage. So I feel like there's, you know, it's not selling really. It's that, you know, the teacher embodies these qualities that are attractive, the method is attractive, and the experience of the class is memorable. And, you know, even if it's just a break in their day where they laugh and they feel good afterwards and they have some community with other people, I mean, people will pay for that. So that's the context to which
Well, like
money.
You know, I think usually when I tell that story, I tell people about where you came from. But I think something I've never related to you is a couple of years ago, someone I know in the community, a friend of a friend, a young guy who was working over the hill in the Silicon Valley, didn't have a job, lost his place to live. And so he came and stayed with me for 5-6 months maybe. And he was working in marketing in the Valley. And he was interested in philosophy and in funding. It was like being in college. We stayed up to like 3 in the morning, nights in a row, talking about stuff. And he was really coming from this, you know, from this framework of kind of modern marketing ideas. And it was one night we were having this conversation, and all of a sudden it hit me. I mean, I think it's, in retrospect, painfully obvious, but you know, it's like you said, if I think about what we offer as something new that people don't know about, right? How do we get to the place? I think in the conversations that we have in the community, it's like, why aren't we as well known as yoga or Pilates or whatever it is? And there's no development there. We're going from being a filament hanging from a tassel on the fringe. We're not even to early adopters yet, right? And so to think about how do we create a strategy, which means we have to have some idea of what we have to offer people, right? And the form in which it happens and where it happens, those are all things I'm kind of ecumenical about that. You know, the question is, I talked a little bit about this morning. I think, like what you said, Lori, about the words, I think in a, this is a little academic perhaps, but there's a linguistic theory called category theory, right? Which talks about how we understand things and the metaphors that we use. One book is called Metaphors That We Live By, for instance. But if we think about the method, there's no category, right? If you say, I'm a Feldenkrais teacher, what does that mean? And, you know, I end up sometimes saying, well, yeah, it's a little like yoga because we're in strange positions. And it's a little like Tai Chi because we move slow, but it's not either one of those. And the fact is, people don't know where to put us. And when I suggested coordination,
Larry, if you're still there, we lost your sound.
I'm wrestling over the word or the idea, but it's kind of Can you hear me now? Am I back? Okay. Sorry about that. The mysteries of the interwebs. You know, when I'm talking about coordination, what I'm saying is that this is something that we have to offer. It's something that people recognize. It's like territory that we can claim. So, you know, what our specialty is helping people develop new skills and improve their coordination. And, you know, I think what Anne said before, like, our bodies are changing throughout our lives. So we tend to think of development and physical education as something that happens early, but we need it throughout our lives, throughout that journey, you know? And this is what we have to offer. It's not about stretching. It's not about strength. It's not about energy flowing. You can talk about it all those ways, but in a simple everyday way, you know, it's about skill. It's, you know, like Moshe said, we're not born this way. We're born with the ability to learn. So how do we harness that? That's something I'm comfortable talking about. I mean, I think that opens possibilities to people. It gets people to think in new ways. And it's like, it's not the only way. I'm not trying to convince anybody that we should do this. I just think it takes a critical number, kind of like what Paula said, but I think like if there was a couple of hundred of us teaching the same ATM class everywhere around the world, and we could talk to each other and the students could talk to each other, that would be the beginning of something. You know, that's something I'm working on creating through the website, so we can have a community that brings students to local teachers, connects the teachers to their students, the students to each other, and us as teachers to each other. That would be cool.
Larry, I'm going to give you a shameless plug.
Okay, wait, let me be shamed first. Okay.
Because I'm going to tell you that things like your course, Returning to the Source, that gives a teacher more insight into what the lesson is about, how to describe what the lesson is about, a deeper understanding of ATM in a way that, gives us more opportunity to explain something to the student, as opposed to saying, find it for yourself, walk around, you see how you're feeling, you tell me next week what you thought. It's very different, to really feel that you have some mastery over what's going on in the lesson. And then just quickly, it costs hundreds of millions of dollars to launch a new brand. If you want to be a new soup or a new dish soap and that's not to say we're not someplace. I mean, we have made advances. But it just occurred to me, we've been kind of waiting for our brand ambassadors to come along. Where's the movie star? Where's the athlete? Where's the person who's going to be our brand ambassador? But we actually could create a campaign with brand ambassadors who don't need to be famous. I mean, it could be just a senior person who's had a car accident, or a young gymnast, or anything. I just think I think it's something we should look into, of having brand ambassadors who, in the age of Instagram, don't need to be really famous, because people are ready to listen to the stories of other people, and they're going to resonate. And I'm sure that that's how a lot of people come to Feldenkrais, because someone who was their friend told them about their experience. So anyway.
Thank you,
yeah, Paula. Thank you, Paula. It's really interesting to have this discussion around, well, how do we engage people and make it, we talk about Instagram influencers and this culture of social media. How can we build that? And the circles that I run in with entrepreneurs, some people are saying that we don't have a lot of time or years left to build that social media influence as a personal brand. So how can we as a whole brand move forward? It's interesting. Looking at how to connect with people, like you were saying, often a story from someone else is a great example. And recently I changed my about section on my page. Often we're asked, well, what do you actually do in a class? And the suggestion is to talk about one of your clients, how what their experience was. And one of mine, she had chronic pain, couldn't walk up her stairs, and now she can move quite a lot easier. So telling those stories really does connect people to what we do. And going back to bringing the dog to class, one of my students online always has her cats, and we call it Feline Feldy because the cat's always walking on her and she's doing it. It's quite fun. She gets extra feedback from the cat sitting on her back when she's on her belly.
It was always amazing to me when I was doing ATM how the dog would always be in the place I was moving to next. Like, how did he know that? Anyway, thanks, Angela. Hey, Catherine. Well, hold on a second. You're not unmuted. There you go. I got, whoops.
Oh,
There you go. That's good.
We both did it at the same time, I think. I'm curious about the comment you made at the beginning about what kind of future we want to make. Mm-hmm. And not always looking in the rear vision mirror of the car. Where I live, which is in Aotearoa, New Zealand, our Indigenous people, and we like to think we live in a very bicultural country, have the mantra that you walk backwards into the future. Mm. Unless you know where you have come from, and your tipuna, which are your ancestors and everything that they've contributed to the world, then you can't walk into the future. But you see, the whole notion of walking backwards I find intriguing, because that's often something we use in Feldenkrais to integrate what we've learnt, because we have fewer habits around it. Mm-hmm. And I think part of our problem, and I find teaching ADM quite challenging. It's not what I started with, because I had some major time issues and health problems, and I found I learned so much more by giving FIs, and I could manage the workload more easily. So I teach only a class once a week. I live in a relatively small city. It's actually hard to even keep a class together at all. And it's often a generalist class. And I know you say you don't teach generalist classes and all that. Anyway, but I think, I do think that there is, we do need to know where we come from, because that gives us the confidence to do things differently. And I have experienced ATM very often. Many people, when they graduate, don't feel confident, either in the FI field or in the ATM field. I think one thing that we could improve on in our trainings is about how do you teach. You know, it's all very well doing hundreds of ATMs on the floor and then saying, okay, now you've done so many, you can get up and teach it. But teaching is very different from just lying on the floor. But I also think you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I've experienced Feldenkrais practitioners who don't, you know, they know a whole lot of the vocabulary, but they don't know any of the grammar. So it isn't put together in any kind of meaningful way. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So it's, and we're kind of, you either sink or swim.
I'm going to sink if you say much more, because I can't keep it all together. But, you know, I think what I find interesting about the way that you're winding through this is how you're bringing these opposites together, right? In a way that's really getting me to think. So, like, you said so much. I am with you. You know, when I was talking about Kano, understanding where we come from, understanding the traditions, I think that's really true. And I certainly, my experience of being in New Zealand one time for a few weeks there and getting to know you and your colleagues and the culture, it's definitely different than our culture, you know, here. I mean, so I appreciate that too. And I think what I meant by driving, looking backwards, is looking at what the method has been. You know, like, I mean, Moshe never wanted to leave Israel, right? So he was home for 6 months and he traveled for 6 months. So the nature of how the method developed had something to do with that. Had some, you know, that the just because the method has been practiced the way it has been practiced in the past doesn't mean it has to look like that in the future. That's what I meant. But I think understanding our roots, understanding where the method comes from, is really and I mean, I say roots because I think there's more than one, but I think that's incredibly valuable. So, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, and I love what you said about having the vocabulary, not the grammar, for teaching, right? That lessons have to be meaningful. They have to be compelling. A lesson is like, it's a story, it's a poem, it's a dance, it's a magic trick, it's all these things. It's not just lying on the floor and wiggling around, right? And so how do you create an experience that carries someone along and that, to use a word from the 60s, you know, that's relevant? I think that answers the so what question. I resonate with what you're saying. And one of the ways that I talk about it, one of the things that comes up for me, like in the AYA Day group, is that we have this discussion that revolves around two different perspectives. One is our experience of the lesson. So this morning, still have it here, we did head and neck, 30 AY 38, which is a lesson. You know, you start out hugging yourself and twisting in all these different ways. And it was a marvelous lesson for me. I did it before I did the morning session, and it was incredible. And I had some moments where we were lying on our backs and our head was up and we were rolling our head, and there's this moment where it's like all these things were happening in my lower back. It was magical. It was wonderful. You know, and I think that's the student's experience. It's my experience practicing the method. I think, you know, part of the conversation is from that perspective, and part of the conversation is from the teacher's perspective. What do we do as teachers to create that experience for the students? And there, we can't just, I can't be just in my experience. I don't want to teach everyone else what I got from the lesson. The lesson is richer than that, right? I mean, I think one of the things that's marvelous about our lessons is, you know, you get up at the end and you think, wow, the teacher was speaking to me. And then so many people in the class think that. What is the structure of creating that? You know, what's the structure of taking, I mean, this lesson, like at one point in the conversation, somebody in the conversation, who I know pretty well, she was in one of my trainings, was talking about Moshe, talking about turning around, twisting your pelvis around your spine. And, you know, it was this point where we were lying on our back, and it was kind of halfway through a spine like a chain. So your pelvis is up in the air and your back is still on the floor, and you're twisting your pelvis without your legs flopping around. So you're turning your pelvis around, and so we were talking about how she was talking about how her pelvis and her head was turning with, or how her chest and her head were turning with her pelvis. And I was talking about understanding the lesson biomechanically, because in every step of the lesson or in the different sections, the positions that we were in were such that they asked the twisting to happen in different places. And I gave some examples about that. So in this position, this is my mother's letter opener, by the way, which I use every day. If you think about this as your chest and this is your spine, your pelvis would be up here. If you twist your spine and your chest is moving, then the twisting is going to be somewhere further. If your head is moving, then everything's moving as a piece. It's undifferentiated. But if the weight of your chest is keeping your chest on the floor and you're moving your pelvis, then you're moving at the place where your spine is meeting your chest, where the just above where you are on the floor. And in that position, right, because you're turning your pelvis, you can't twist in the lower part of your lumbar spine because those joints are lower than your pelvis. I mean, you're moving your pelvis, if you are, around your spine. You have enough tone in the lower part of your belly and lower back that, and you use up that little bit of movement of rotation in your lumbar spine pretty quickly. So you have to move somewhere above that. If the movement's small enough, then you've shifted the movement to a different place. You've taken away the place you might turn, and you're doing it in a different place. There's a place where you're in the lesson where you're lying on your belly and you're tilting your legs separately and then holding them together and tilting them. And then the leg that comes down, you're lifting the knee, the top knee of the two legs. So as you tilt your legs to the side, you might remember that from another ATM lesson, but that again changes where the twisting is happening. And I think there, to be able to see the means whereby, to use a term from F. Matthias Alexander, the means whereby Moshe constructs these experiences that where we change, and the way that the lesson is built on that. But you know, I don't see that as a student. I just have my experience. So I think, I mean, we teach experientially. I don't think we can teach the method without being connected to it as students, as people who practice it, not just teach it. But I think we have to understand it from its perspective as a methodology, right? And I think that there, Catherine, it's not just the terminology, but it's how to, you know, Moshe said an ATM is an environment for learning. You know, I think of my job as a teacher as being a guide. So how do I create a journey that brings somebody to being more capable? And there's a structure to that. And that's what I think that's Moshe's, that's his methodology. And that's what I think we need to be able to understand and talk about to each other. And that has to be behind our teaching. And then there's what we tell people they can do with it. All right. Well, it's great to see you, Catherine. It's really cool to have this way of, you know, just meeting up. And, you know, I'm a fairly impromptu person, so it's just wonderful to say, hey, do you want to get together and talk? And y'all show up. And, I can see the wheels turning, as my mom would have said. You may not be saying anything, but I can see the wheels turning. And I appreciate your willingness to be part of it. I'm curious if there's anybody, we have a few minutes left, who hasn't said anything, who would like to chime in.
This is Julie from Seattle. I really appreciate this conversation. It's really, really rich. And I'm still way back at the beginning of the conversation with that great question of can we imagine a world where Feldenkrais fits? I that's just really sparked me. And the question of what is this method that we're doing and practicing and continuing to learn, and it makes, and how do we articulate it, and what is it, and all these things that it is not. It's not exercise, it's not relaxation, it's not mindfulness, it's all of that. And it makes me think of another one of the roots of, I don't know about roots, but a one stream, and that's the Gurdjieff work, which is a path that I studied for many, many years in my 20s and 30s. And there was that same element. It's like, how do I tell anybody what the Gurdjieff work is about? It was just like, well, it's not this, it's this. And it's, I think that it's like a honest problem that we have. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because what the method is, I'm still learning it. I'm still in a training program. It is so incredibly rich and has so much depth. And listening to various of you talking about it, and people, you know, having the chutzpah a little bit to disagree with Larry. I loved that, Lori, and it made me think about. I'm also a dancer, an improviser, and there's a method that has a lot to do with dancing that's called Skinner releasing, developed by Joan Skinner, and. One of the things I love about the Skinner releasing method is that the dancers that it produces, you know, many dance forms, the dancers that different forms can produce can look very much the same, which mm-hmm. is not necessarily a bad thing, but it is an element. But with Skinner releasing, it's produced people, like there's a whole branch of people in Skinner releasing that do dancing and aerial dancing and other kinds of dancers, and to me that just speaks of the depth of that form, that it can produce all these different people, can look like really different dancers, but they're still practicing the same method. And to me that is speaks volumes about it. And I felt like I was hearing the same thing. It's like, it's coordination. No, it's resilience. No, it's about learning how to learn. And I was just making some notes on my computer here about some of my thoughts of what I think the method is. And in a way, it's a problem that I appreciate. Mm-hmm. Because it just holds so much richness, and the element of, like I think Lori, you also said, it's also about mental health and not just the physical. But I think it's, I mean, I remember someone telling me once that Moshe said, well, he just chose to use the body because it was something we all have every moment, and that, but he could have taught the method through, you know, welding or cooking or car mechanics. And so I just love that. And I think it's, in a way, it's a good problem to have. It's still something to really grapple with, but
yeah,
I love that element of it.
Well, Julie, I love that you brought up Skinner releasing technique. I'm a first generation contact improv dancer.
Oh, I was at a contact jam today.
And I was at a toe jam today, but that's a different thing. Sorry, just a little silly. But you know, so I've done that work, well, before I did Feldenkrais, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, a long time ago. Project Arto, San Francisco, 1970, whatever that was. Remember, Norma? Oh, my God. Anyway, but you said some things that I think are really precious. It is an honest question, right? And I think, I don't want to make it go away. That's really why I wanted to open the floor. And, yeah, we don't need to, this is about finding something together. So agreeing is, you know, we can get to something, but we don't have to start there. I talked about Herbert Brunn, and I think Herbert and Heinz von Forster, who was one of the granddaddies of cybernetics, I mean, they were for me, they were a counterexample for how Moshe taught and who he was, and they came from very different places. I learned a lot from them. But Herbert had this, there's another thing he said. He said, you know, that there's a problem with the question, what is? Because when we answer the question, what is, it's kind of final. This is that. And the world's more complicated. So he said, and I like this question, when is Feldenkrais? When are we doing Feldenkrais? Not what is it, but when is it happening? I'm back to, you know, liking verbs over nouns. And in the flow of something happening and changing. You know, what is nails things down. When is it, it keeps them alive. So maybe that's another way to think about it too.
And that made me think about the question of, okay, what is Feldenkrais for me right now as I'm sitting on my red sofa and listening to you all, and how am I doing it or not doing it, or what's the possibility of integrating something from that path while I'm sitting here and listening? So I love that question of when.
Cool. Well, look, y'all, I'm curious to hear from folks that haven't said anything. If you want to say something, it's an invitation, not an obligation. Some of you I know, so I know you think and have things to say, but you know, you're not required, but last chance.
Hi, Lara, I'm a little confused. This is Hilda. I'm wondering, when you say we have to provide an appropriate context in our teaching so that the students get a sense of the lesson in a way that I'm not quite sure what you're saying. If you're saying something like when you were describing the head and back lesson, that they understand that they were, you know, lifting their pelvis and rotating and they were moving that joint. I guess it's a little confusing to me what you're saying, because in my training, often the teachers didn't answer questions.
So let me say just a couple of things about that, or maybe just one thing since it's late. that's not what I was saying. You know, I'm not saying that how we teach the method in the context that we teach it. I think there's a lot of varieties. I don't think the student has to know how the lesson works. I don't have to know how the mechanic fixes the car, but that's a different thing because that's not about me. I mean, in the lesson, I'm learning about me. But look, I'll say it as simply as I can. You can teach the method any way you want. You can teach the method in such a way that you help people understand how they're designed for moving from a physical or mechanical way. You can teach it about the mysteries of the way our nervous system works and how perception is part of movement. You can teach the method in a way that is phenomenal and mysterious, and things happen in ways that nobody understands. That those are your values as a teacher. I don't have any illusion that I get to tell you anything about that. I don't want to. Here's what I'm saying. I don't think the lessons should be a mystery to the teacher.
Okay, that's very clear. I understand now. Yes.
Thank you.
For some reason, I was thinking that was what...
No, I understand. I understand, but I appreciate a chance to clarify.
Yeah.
Well, look, I'm going to say goodnight. If you're not a member of the website, you know, my website has we host the lesson locator, which is an online search engine for the Alexander Yanai lessons, for the lessons from that Moshe taught at Peter Brook's Theater, and for, we just added the lessons from the ATM book. So you can search there by, you can search for the actual words in the lesson and for other things. That's free. If you have a membership, there are 300 ATM transcripts written by the trainees of the program that Elizabeth Berenger and I directed in Strasbourg in the 90s. And those are available for anybody who has an account. So, you know, please avail yourself of that. We're going to be putting more stuff there. And, you know, if I'm going to make one plug, I mean, there's my workshop. You can find out about it online. But those of you who have not been a part of the AYA Day group, you know, it's really awesome. Somebody said to me, was it last night or the night before in the well, I call one the Atlantic class and the Pacific class, the one that just stopped a little while ago. Somebody says, you know, well, why do you come? You don't have to show up. You know, you're a trainer. And, you know, I come because, well, when I was in graduate school, I lived 3.5 hours from the closest Feldenkrais teacher. And I moved from the Bay Area where I was a half an hour from the closest person and where there was a community. And I for me, being a part of the community, having these conversations, one of the most thrilling moments I had was this earlier this year was when somebody from that training in Strasbourg taught an ATM on the AYA Day group. And so there was one of my chickies teaching and I got to do the lesson and it was awesome, you know? And, you know, just, I can't do this alone. I don't want to do it alone. And, you know, there's a funny thing about the work that we do. I remember when I was starting my practice, I was living here in Santa Cruz and I was seeing like 30 some people a week at the physical therapy clinic and teaching a couple of ATM classes. And I had this awful feeling at the end of the day that I went home and it was like, you know, if you're an artist, you can take a picture of what you created, but it was like, there was nothing left. People took it with them. And that's when I want to have colleagues to talk about what we're doing and to have the backstage conversations that we're having now and to learn from each other and just to share the journey. So if you haven't been there, it's incredible. You know, I mean, I don't love how everybody teaches ATMs and there's some people who I like better than others, but it's great because there's all these different things. And, you know, you're what you said, Julie, I mean, everybody is honestly working on the method and on themselves. And it's sincere, it's heartfelt, and it's really cool. And it gives me great hope to start my day or end my day with, you know, the rest of you. So thank you. I will bid you good day, good morning, good afternoon, good night. I'm glad I did this late so people would come from the other side of the ocean. Thanks for showing up, y'all.
Makes a difference.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you.
Love. Thanks, Larry. Thanks, everyone. Bye.